The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. My name is Anthony Chibariwe, and I'm filling in for your regular host, Stephen Fleury. We pre-recorded this program because it's airing on the Day of Atonement, a day that we observe based not only on what the Bible says about the Day of Atonement in the Old Testament, but also on what the Bible says about the Day of Atonement in the New Testament. On the show today, we'll talk about history's undefeated general, a man so ambitious, so victorious, that it took him 3 decades to accomplish what the average military leader will take 3 lifetimes to accomplish. We'll talk about Alexander the Great and what Bible prophecy said about him and what I think is the most important lesson we can take from his accomplishments. In 331 BC, Alexander the Great obliterated the Persian Empire. We'll fast forward 2,000 years and talk about the modern descendants of the Persians. We'll talk about the Iranians, why their leaders are leading the rise of Islamic terrorism, and why we watch this trend with a very keen eye. A man once accused Iran of sponsoring terrorism and for doing so with the collusion of certain rogue nations of this world. That actually didn't make him any different from you, probably. That certainly didn't make him any different from me or from officials in the United States intelligence community or the State Department. That didn't make him any different from multiple millions of people who understand the terrifying reality that Iran is the number one state sponsor of terrorism. What made him different from most people, and you can thank God about this difference, is that he was found dead with a bullet in his head just 1 day before he was scheduled to testify before the legislature in Argentina about what? About Iran's terror network in Latin America, and about the state support Iran received in the region. His name is Alberto Nisman. He was a special prosecutor investigating the worst terrorist attack in Argentine history. This was the bombing of a Jewish community center on July 18, 1994, which killed 85 people and wounded more than 300 others. His investigations had revealed Iran's chilling role in that attack, but they had also revealed that the administration of President Cristina Kirchner of Argentina had been covering up Iran's involvement in that attack. On January 14, 2015, he filed a complaint against President Kirchner and some officials in the administration for the cover-up, and it was scheduled to present his testimony on January 19, 2015. But just 1 day before that, he was assassinated, if you can believe it. Assassinated for investigating a crime that had happened 21 years earlier. A crime that had Iranian fingerprints all over the place. Now, this is obviously not a new development, but it's not as widely known as it should. And so I want to talk a little bit more about it, because it reveals some of the methods Iran uses to conduct terror. And I think it also reveals Iran's terrifying dedication to terrorism. So here's what Nisman had dug up before he was murdered. The mastermind of the attack was an Iranian intelligence official named Mohsen Rabbani. European intelligence officials had been keeping a, an eye on him because he had been working in Germany before moving to Argentina. Now, in Argentina, he operated under three different covers. The first cover that he had was a halal meat inspector. That is, he was inspecting meat to just make sure that it was prepared as prescribed by Muslim law. He also operated under the cover of a Shiite cleric and also under the cover of a cultural attaché at the Iranian embassy in Argentina. In Argentina, this Iranian intelligence officer started coordinating an extensive network of Iranian operatives at Iranian embassies in Germany, Spain, Brazil, Colombia, Venezuela, Chile, Uruguay, Cuba, and Mexico. Now, this is very, very critical information because even as recently of June of this year, we heard about an Iranian diplomat stationed in Austria who allegedly masterminded a terrorist attack in France. And we reported about this at thetrumpet.com. And as recently as August, just last month, France restricted travel by its diplomats to Iran because, as the French Foreign Ministry wrote, the behavior of the Iranian authorities suggests a hardening of their position vis-a-vis our country as well as some of our allies. Now, France is one of those European nations that have moved in to try to fill the gap that was left when the United States withdrew from the Iran nuclear deal. And they've been cozying up to the Iranians, trying to negotiate with the Iranians, trying to keep the nuclear deal. And now they are learning the hard way that Iran is a terrorist nation and they are hardening their positions against their country and their allies. It seems like some things never change. We'll talk a little bit more about this in a minute, but we'll take a quick break. Please stay tuned because we'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily.
The prophet Daniel wrote about a future confrontation between a power in the north and the king of the south. We are now in the time when these two major powers are quickly rising. The king of the south is stirring up trouble even today. It is critical that you know the identity of this prophesied power. For more, request our booklet, King of the South. Visit thetrumpet.com and click the literature tab to select your free booklet.
The Trumpet Daily.
Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily radio show. I'm Anthony Chabarire, filling in for your regular host, Stephen Fleury. Let's get back to the attack in Argentina. Iranian embassies in Brazil and Colombia collaborated with Hezbollah operatives in those countries to provide logistical support for the attack. These embassies established multiple front companies for their criminal activities. One of those companies transported Iranian-made explosives that were used in the bombing. That particular company had actually been under economic sanctions before the Iran nuclear deal, and when the Iran nuclear deal was signed, those sanctions were lifted because of the deal. And I'm sure now those sanctions have been slapped back under the Trump administration. But that's just how criminal this company was and is. Now, just prior to the bombing, Iran abruptly increased its communications among its Latin American operatives. But for security purposes, it shifted from electronic communications to couriers, a move that necessitated even more undercover Iranian agents infiltrating the continent. After the attack, Iran strove hard to cover its tracks. Iran repeatedly pleaded with Argentine authorities for impunity over the attack. And Venezuela encouraged Argentina to reason with Iran. Iran started providing Cristina Kirchner with political and financial support in exchange for exonerating Tehran in its role in the 1994 terrorist attack. That support even included funding for her presidential campaign in 2007. Special Prosecutor Alberto Nisman called it a criminal plan to whitewash Iran's fingerprints. And just 1 month before he died, Alberto Nisman requested that the United Nations activate Chapter 7 of the UN Charter so it could get more involved in the case and for Iran to extradite those responsible for the bombing. Let me read to you what the Center for a Secure Free Society reported about this. Quote, Nisman's strategy to take the case to the United Nations Security Council took place at a time when Iran was in intense nuclear negotiations. These nuclear negotiations, which began in secret in 2012 and became public in 2013, ran parallel to the controversial Memorandum of Understanding signed by Iran and Argentina. The Memorandum of Understanding was the basis for Nisman's allegations of criminal conspiracy because, according to the prosecutor, it was negotiated secretly to offer impunity to Iran. The 1994 bombing was a stark reminder to the international community of Iran's troubled history with international terrorism. Alberto Nisman's decade-long work from the 2006 indictment to his most recent 2015 judicial complaint ensured remembrance of this fact. And I hope it does bring remembrance of this fact. The quote continues, his equally important 2013 dictum on Iran's extending networks of terror in Latin America served to remind us that the threat from Iran is not just confined to the Middle East. It is clear and present throughout our hemisphere. End quote. Iran is the nation it is today because of the Islamic Revolution of 1979. Following that radical change in Iran, Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini declared, quote, we shall export our revolution to the whole world until the cry Allah Akbar resounds over the whole world. There will be struggle. End quote. And that phrase, Allahu Akbar, is written 22 times on the Iranian flag. This is something really important to Iranian leaders. The Ayatollah also made this declaration, quote, we must settle our accounts with great and superpowers and show them that we can take on the whole world ideologically, despite all the painful problems that face us. End quote. Now in 1989, just about 3 years after the revolution, Iran hosted a conference of more than two dozen regional nations about the ideal Islamic government. This conference regarded Islam as a weapon in revolutionary wars against the rich and the contempt. The Islamic religion would wake Muslims from the sleep of centuries. That's what they said at this conference. The Islamic religion would wake Muslims from the sleep of centuries, putting a sword in their hands and sending them into battle against the forces of Satan. Ayatollah Khomeini pledged his wholehearted support for all movements and groups that are fighting to gain liberation from superpowers of the left and of the right. These were his words. He pledged his wholehearted support for all movements and groups that are fighting to gain liberation from superpowers of the left and of the right. Veteran reporter Robin Wright describes this conference as a turning point in global Iranian-sponsored Islamic revolution. At the time, the West largely ignored this conference in Iran. She writes this in a book titled Sacred Rage. Quote, 2 years later, however, nervous cabinet ministers in oil-rich Gulf states, State Department analysts in Washington, and Soviet envoys in Beirut looked back on the conference with both frustration and concern, all by then trying to find out more about it. For the names of the clergymen who attended that seminar had come back to haunt the vulnerable sheikdoms as well as the power centers on four continents. End quote. Now, that was in 1984. The year that the State Department first designated Iran as a state sponsor of terrorism, following devastating Iranian-sponsored terrorist attacks in Kuwait, Lebanon, and other nations. And many of these attacks involved suicide bombings. Before these devastating attacks, the rational concept of warfare was that you do not win a war by dying for your country, but by making the enemy die for his. But Iran was beginning to change that. It was reversing that. And about exactly that, Ayatollah Khomeini declared this: the more people who die for our cause, the stronger we shall become. In 1984, the State Department held its own conference about the threat in Iran. And the director for the Center of Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Chicago was there at the conference. His name is Marvin Zonis. And he said this: the message from Iran, no matter how bizarre or trivial it sounds on first, second, fourth, or 39th hearing, is, in my opinion, the single most impressive political ideology which has been proposed in the 20th century since the Bolshevik Revolution. This powerful message will be with us for a very long time, no matter what happens to Ayatollah Khomeini. Now, you said that in 1984. Is that message still with us today? Well, last Tuesday was September 11th. The 17th anniversary of the worst terrorist attack on American soil. And of course, Al-Qaeda conducted those attacks, but Iran facilitated and supported the Al-Qaeda terrorists who conducted those attacks on September 11, 2001. And just 3 months ago, Iran admitted to this sort of support, and this was the very first time that an Iranian official had admitted to working and funding Al-Qaeda and supporting Al-Qaeda before 9/11. The senior Iranian official, he said this in an interview. He said, Al-Qaeda's movements through Iran was under the complete supervision of the Iranian intelligence. Now, the State Department, It releases annual reports about terrorism, global terrorism, and each time, each year, Iran is listed as a dangerous state sponsor of terrorism. And it says that Iran's support for Al-Qaeda is ongoing to this day. The Obama administration, it altered the wording in some of those reports during the time of negotiating for the nuclear deal. It did say that Iran did support Al-Qaeda, but it made it seem like that was all in the past. But now under the Trump administration, those State Department reports indicate that Iran's support for Al-Qaeda is ongoing to this day. Iran's support for Hamas in the Gaza Strip, Hezbollah in Lebanon and Syria, the Houthi rebels in Yemen, the Taliban in Afghanistan, it's also ongoing to this day. And reports indicate that in the past, Iran even sponsored Islamic State terrorists. Do you know that state sponsorship of terrorism is almost exclusively Iranian? Could that reality possibly help identify a Middle Eastern power that is described in the Bible as having a violently forceful foreign policy? Daniel 11 verse 40 reads this, "And at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots and with horsemen and with many ships. And he shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over." The king of the north here is a German-led Europe. And the king of the south here is radical Islam led by Iran. Listen to this clip from Mr. Gerald Fleury, the editor-in-chief of thetrumpet.com and the presenter of the Key of David television program. And this is from 2015, but it's very relevant. Here's clip one.
But this prophecy in Daniel 11 and verse 40 is about Germany having a secret strategy to destroy Iran, who happens to be the king of the south in that prophecy. Now, that destruction includes Iran and all of radical Islam allied with them. That is a prophecy in your Bible, and what is happening in Libya today is very much a part of that prophecy. In recent news, you heard about the 21 Egyptian Coptic Christians who were beheaded by ISIS just before they were beheaded, saying, "Jesus, help me." And all 21 of them were in a bloody massacre. Now, if you look at these Egyptian Christians, they were just going there to try to find work for their families. And so it's quite a pitiful story. But there is a U.S. general who said that the face of radical Islam is now ISIS. But I disagree with that strongly. The face of radical Islam is still Iran many times over. And the Bible tells you that because Iran is the king of the South or the Middle East. But also history tells us that. And just the what is happening on the world scene tells us that even right now. So look at the power of Iran. Here they've just got control of Yemen and can now control really all of the flow of oil and other goods through the most important trade route in the world, through the Red Sea and the Suez Canal. They have control of Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, and now Yemen, and that means they have Saudi Arabia and those oil-producing states surrounded. And that is a very frightening scenario if you understand the importance of oil in this world. Now, Iran also has one of the greatest oil-producing nations in the world, and they're the number one terrorist-sponsoring nation in this world by far. And they also are about to get the nuclear bomb, and they already have intercontinental ballistic missiles that they can put those nuclear warheads on and cause worldwide crises like you've never, ever seen before. But if you look at ISIS, well, they don't even have an air force. And they, in many ways, are a distraction. Now, they are dangerous, no question about that. But in many ways, they are a distraction of what is happening in the Middle East through Iran. And we need to understand this because this is going to affect every single one of us. Now, if you look at ISIS today, they're like a mouse compared to the Iranian tiger. There is no comparison. But Iran is just a little more clever and not being quite so violent and not creating quite so many enemies as ISIS, but they too, even the Iranians, have said that they are going to wipe Israel off the map. And they're going to, they cry death to America. They want to destroy America as well. And when they get those long-range intercontinental ballistic missiles, they can do it, along with the nuclear bomb. So they are a deadly, dangerous country.
Iran is indeed a deadly, dangerous country. And the fact of the matter is, it is going to get even more dangerous. The sanctions Iran faced before the nuclear deal did not make Iran less dangerous. The nuclear deal itself did not make Iran less dangerous. The Trump administration's withdrawal from the nuclear deal did not make Iran less dangerous. And President Donald Trump's severe sanctions on Iran are not making Iran less dangerous. Actually, economic pressure on Iran is actually hardening Iran's hardliners. On August 28, Iranian lawmakers summoned President Hassan Rouhani to parliament and grilled him about the worsening economic crisis in Iran, that it only happened just once before in Iran's history, summoning a sitting president to parliament for questioning. And they rejected all but one of his plans to address the economic crisis. Now, following that development in Iran, Geopolitical Futures made this comment, quote, "As the crisis drags on, the relative silence of the country's hardliners is becoming more difficult to ignore." And that is important. That is an important trend that we need to watch. And we'll continue watching that because Bible prophecy shows that Iran is not going to moderate. Its hardliners are not going to get softer. They're actually going to get harder and harder and harder until they completely fulfill the prophecy in Daniel 11, verse 40. Well, you're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send your comments or feedback to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. The world is hopelessly confused about Bible history and prophecy. Understanding the Daniel 2 image could clear up most of that confusion. The Daniel 2 image gives an overview of history and prophecy like nothing else in the Bible. The Bible is a masterful work that should be studied in its entirety. The book of Daniel and the images described therein actually unlock the meaning of the prophecies in the book of Revelation. Our free booklet, Daniel Unlocks Revelation, explains the incredible prophecies contained in these two books. Studied alongside your Bible, this booklet, Daniel Unlocks Revelation, will bring the history and prophecy of your Bible to life. Request your free copy today. There is absolutely no cost or obligation. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. This is KPCG-FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily.
Throughout the glorious and terrible history of conquest, one name towers above all others. One warrior, one king, one legend. Alexander the Great.
Never in all the world was there another like him.
Born of a ruthless mother.
He believed that she was a consort of some higher being.
Educated by a brilliant philosopher.
One of the most influential thinkers in the world, Aristotle.
Driven by a domineering father.
And they swiftly drew their swords. Then the blood really flowed.
A Macedonian warrior at 14. A general at 18. King at 20. Commanding 40,000 troops, hungry for total war. Leaving a grand legacy and a controversial history that endure to this day.
Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. You just listened to the introduction to a History Channel documentary about Alexander the Great, history's undefeated general. One of the most remarkable things about him is that the prophet Daniel prophesied about him in stunning detail. The prophecy is so detailed and precise that some skeptics think that Daniel merely recorded history after the fact. But this was prophecy written some 200 years in advance. We have three booklets that explain precisely how Daniel's prophecies were fulfilled. And if you'd like copies, we'll be very happy to mail them to you for free. These booklets are Daniel Unsealed at Last, History and Prophecy of the Middle East, and Who or What is the Prophetic Beast? And if you'd like copies, just go to thetrumpet.com and click on the Literature tab, and you can order your free copies. We'll pay for the shipping, and we'll be very happy to do that for you. Daniel chapter 2 and Daniel chapter 7 record prophecies about four great world empires. And the first one was the Babylonian Empire, which was followed by the Persian Empire, and then the Greco-Macedonian Empire, and finally the Roman Empire. We were talking a little earlier about the modern descendants of the Persian Empire, the Iranians. Now let's go back 2,500 years back to when God gave Daniel the prophecies about the Persian Empire. Daniel recorded what God showed him in Daniel chapter 8. And I'll read some of those prophecies beginning Daniel 8 verse 3. Then I lifted up my eyes and saw, and behold, there stood before the river a ram, which had two horns. And the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other. And the higher came up last. I saw the ram pushing westward and northward and southward, so that no beasts might stand before him, neither was there any that could deliver out of his hand, but he did according to his will and became great. And as I was considering, behold, an he-goat came from the west on the face of the whole world and touched not the ground. And the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. And he came to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing before the river, and ran unto him in the fury of his power. And I saw him come close unto the ram, and he was moved with choler against him, and smote the ram, and broke his two horns. And there was no power in the ram to stand before him. But he cast him down to the ground, and stamped upon him, and there was none that could deliver the ram out of his hand. Therefore the he-goat waxed very great. And when he was strong, the great horn was broken, and for it came up four notable ones towards the four winds of heaven. Obviously, these are all symbols, and the Bible interprets its own symbols. I'll read that interpretation beginning in verse 19. Actually, I'll skip to verse 20. It says, "The ram which you saw having two horns are the kings of Media and Persia. And the rough goat is the king of Greece. And the great horn that is between his eyes is the first king. And that first king was Alexander the Great." And I'd like to talk a little bit more about him. And I'd like to share with you what I think is the most important lesson we all can take from his life. There is a reason why he's called Alexander the Great. He was never defeated in battle. His father, King Philip of Macedon, saw to it that his son received the best education that he possibly could get. So he hired what were considered the best minds in Greece at that time. As a result of his father's pursuit of a good education for his son, Alexander developed a love for learning and for literature. According to the historian Plutarch, when Alexander was only 10 years old, actually, he tamed this wild horse named Bucephalus and impressed his father so much that he said, "My son, seek you out a kingdom equal to yourself. Macedonia has not room for you." At the age of 16, he was leading divisions of the Macedonian army. He was a shrewd politician and a chief executive who understood how to use vassals and forge useful alliances. His military doctrine focused on creating an army whose skill overcame its smallness. He led from the front, and he knew how to inspire men. The historian Arrian wrote this about Alexander the Great when he was confronting the Persian army of Darius. Quote, "Meantime, Darius advanced to battle with 400,000 foot soldiers and 100,000 on horseback. So vast a multitude of enemies caused some distrust in Alexander when he contemplated the smallness of his own army. But he called to mind at the same time how much he had already done and how powerful people he had overthrown with that very moderate force. His hopes therefore prevailed over his apprehensions, and thinking it more hazardous to defer the contest lest dismay should fall upon his men, he rode around among his troops and addressed those of each nation in an appropriate speech. He excited the Ilians and the Thracians by describing the enemy's wealth and treasures, and the Greeks by putting them in mind of their wars of old, their deadly hatred toward the Persians. He reminded the Macedonians at one time of their conquests in Europe, and at another of their desire to subdue Asia, boasting that no troops in the world had been found a match for them, and assuring them that this battle would put an end to their labors and crown their glory." End quote. In 12 years, Alexander the Great expanded his empire to include Persia, parts of Europe, Central Asia, Afghanistan, and India. The World's Generals series has a book about Alexander the Great by Bill Yin. And Worsley Clark, who is a retired general of the United States Army, he wrote the foreword of that book. And I like to read a good bit of it because I think it's a very good summary of Alexander's accomplishments and legacy. He writes, quote, Alexander the Great was the first great military commander of the West. Before him were legends or mere mortals. After him, all were emulators. No one since has moved as far, as rapidly, or as successfully, given their respective technologies, not Julius Caesar, not Hannibal, not Genghis Khan, not Gustavus Adolphus, not Napoleon, not the armies of Hitler or Stalin. Bill Yin's fast-moving and insightful biography of Alexander is the best yet at drawing out the lessons from history's first and greatest undefeated general. It is more than a record of battles and campaigns. Rather, it is a remarkable and compelling life story. Alexander's life was to fight and conquer, to craft and lead armies, to seek and solve complex tactical and strategic challenges, whether they were military, logistical, or geographic. He sowed fear in the psyche of his enemies and reached deeply into the hearts and minds of his followers to grasp the deepest wellsprings of motivation, courage, and commitment. No one has ever done all this more successfully. His physical gifts were awesome. Strength, coordination, stamina, eyesight. Even his physical appearance was impressive. By age 16, he was mature enough physically and emotionally to command a wing of an army. He thrust and swung his weapons with extraordinary effect. By his example, he challenged others. And you must have learned and grown stronger with each bout and battle. In the modern lexicon, his skills and learning might be best understood as a professional athlete, say an NFL quarterback, who consistently delivers something beyond the playbook, whose instincts and on-field presence carry the team beyond the coach. But to carry the analogy forward, most of his opponents were not even on the same league. They hadn't been schooled and hardened in the incessant conflict of Greece. They hadn't been coached and tutored by the best, and they hadn't been seasoned by so much leadership and responsibility from an early age. At West Point, we studied his lessons tactically. All the principles of war that we study date back to Alexander. The principles of the objective, mass, maneuver, the offensive, economy of force, security, surprise, and simplicity. He used maneuvers to break up enemy's plans and to seize and maintain the initiative. He was active. He imposed his plans on the enemy. He was adaptable and relentless in pursuing decisive tactical advantage. In battle after battle, open battlefield, siege and pursuit, as Alexander marched through Asia, these principles shine through. His legacy has thus formed the basis of over 2,000 years of Western military thought. No less remarkable were Alexander's strategic logistics and communications. He kept his army focused on long-range objectives. He periodically halted, refreshed, and reorganized. He maintained contact with the reaches of his far-flung and growing empire by courier. He didn't overcommit, outrun his logistics, or collapse back on his line of communications. The legacy of Alexander endures to inform and will inspire generations to come. He did it all without defeat. He was in the cockpit of command earlier, longer, at greater personal risk, and more successfully than any who followed. Now, that's a quote from a retired military general who clearly was impressed by Alexander and evidently learned from the life of Alexander the Great. After going through all of that, how impressed are you by Alexander the Great? How much can you learn from him? Are you as great as Alexander? How do you even accurately compare yourself to someone like Alexander the Great? Well, the Bible tells us exactly how we can accurately do that. It tells us that in Proverbs 16, verse 32, and I'll read that to you. He that is slow to anger is better than the mighty, and he that rules his spirit than he that takes a city. A lot of us do not have the title, the great, appended to our names. We are not taking cities or conquering nations or empires. But what the Bible is saying here is that if we can rule our spirit, if we have self-control, God considers us to be much better than these great men of history. And many of them, including Alexander the Great, had some major moral and spiritual issues, to say the least. Taking a city is not that much of a big deal to God, but being morally disciplined is. It might not earn you an impressive title now. The History Channel might not be interested in doing a documentary about you, and military generals might not write forewords to books written about you, but you would be very impressive to God. The question, therefore, is how much is it worth to you and to me? Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury has a book titled How to Be an Overcomer. You can order a free copy of that book at thetrumpet.com. The book is about overcoming spiritually. And in that book, Mr. Fleury draws some lessons from Napoleon. He acknowledges that Napoleon was a ruthless dictator, but he said Napoleon's life contained principles and examples we can emulate in order to better fight our spiritual war. In other words, he that takes a city is not anywhere close to being as great as he that rules his spirit. Well, that's all we have for today. Thanks for joining us today on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email us with comments, please send those to td@kpcg.fm. Have a wonderful day.